Are you an unhappy Netflix subscriber? Are you a smartphone user or considering upgrading your dumb phone? Are you worried about how the debt ceiling debate might affect your money? Well, then you'll want to stay tuned for this edition of On Your Money. Financial planner Kevin McKinley will have thoughts on all those topics and answers to your personal finance questions. Good morning. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's 8 minutes past 8 o'clock on this Tuesday, July the 19th. If you have a question for Kevin, 1-800-642-1234, or you can send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. Kevin McKinley is a certified financial planner, managing member of McKinley Money LLC with offices in Madison and Eau Claire, and he joins us from our studios in Eau Claire. I think this is the right button. Good morning, Kevin.
Yes, that is the right button. Good morning, Joy.
I have a question for you, Kevin.
Go right ahead.
Is it hot enough for you?
It's not the heat, it's the stupidity. That's the problem. We live in a place where we will probably, at least especially if you invoke the wind chill, we'll probably have a 150-degree swing between today and sometime next February. And you look at places like Colorado or New Mexico or Northern California, they, you know, are all the way up to 81 degrees with no humidity right now. And then, you know, most of those places sink down to a chilly 52 degrees in the worst of winter. So I'm starting to wonder. I've lived here almost all my life. I love it. I probably will live here the rest of my life. But it's days like today, I start to wonder why.
Yeah, you know, though, this is only going to be a week or so, and winter is 6 months, right?
Good point. Wait, what?
I know, it's going to be a real miserable week. Look, you know, speaking of stupidity, I still have a dumb phone. And apparently, I might want to consider getting a smartphone to save some money. Is that right, that smartphone users are saving people money?
Well, it seems that smartphones are becoming more ubiquitous. The Pew Center says that about 37% of all cell phone subscribers now are smartphone users. These would be the iPhone, phones that operate on the Android platform or the BlackBerry. And it's a number that's probably going to escalate because more than half of all new cell phone purchases are smartphones. It's by far the fastest growing segment of the cell phone market. And the nice thing about many of these devices is because they are so incredibly adept at so many different things, people are spending not only less time with other electronic devices, but they're also spending less money on it using the smartphone as a replacement.
So what services and gadgets would a smartphone replace?
More than one might imagine. Even I do have a smartphone, and a lot of the things that are on there that I find that I'm not, I've cobwebs are gathering on various electronic items that I once couldn't live without. Well, first of all, about a quarter of all adults right now live in a household that's wireless only. So that includes your dumb phone, but also smartphones as well. So they're giving up their landline. They are very adept in a limited way at using for the internet surfing. Many households that either don't want or can't afford broadband access use their smartphone to surf the web, to do work on as well. They obviously use it as a music player with iTunes, and many of the newer ones like the iPhone have a speaker on it, so you don't even need to plug it in to the headphones. It can be a radio, it can be a video player as well, especially with the better technology in both streaming and playing. My kids watch movies in the car on the way home just by sitting staring at the stupid iPhone. Gaming, many gamers right now are moving off Xbox, the Wii, etc., and going to directly to their smartphones because not only can the games go wherever they do, but they're much, much cheaper. And finally, television. GPS devices. I have a GPS app I use for 99 cents, and the Garmin has gone away. And I even have an app that was free that I use, where it makes a really great flashlight in a pinch. And it also was my alarm clock that woke me up this morning to come to the radio studio.
Sounds good. So where should I start looking if I don't have the smartphone yet?
Well, sadly, if you if you are lusting after a particular model, you still have to start with the provider, the one that offers the best cell phone service and reception in your area, and then decide based on the uses, are you going to be calling, are you going to be texting, watching video, working on it by actually using it as almost a laptop computer. Some of the top sellers are obviously the iPhone, but the Droid market, this is the Android platform, are coming up. There's a Windows-based phone that is becoming a little more popular, but probably won't ever reach the status of the iPhone. And then even Google has a plan to come up with a Google phone as well. The iPhone and the Droid platform, though, are by far the two most popular and the most beloved.
It's going to take me a while to go through all those choices, though. But are there any downsides, Kevin, to using a smartphone for all of this electronic activity?
Well, I'm 45 years old, which is, the median age in America the last time I saw, I think, was about 35. So I'm officially older. I'm not going to say I'm old, but I'm older. This thing is portable, for better or for worse. And that means it goes anywhere you can just about, but it also means that it's very difficult to actually enter data and even to see a lot of the things that you're used to seeing in 52 inches or 21 inches on your PC screen. There are Bluetooth keyboards that you can use to enter data in there. They're not perfect, but they're a better solution than trying to type in with especially if you have normal size thumbs and fingers. If you have a lot of uses or apps or time that you're going to spend on this smartphone, you are going to end up paying a lot more for data than you once might have, because many of these companies now are seeing that a lot of the movies are taking up a lot of the room on the bandwidth, mm-hmm. and they're saying, you know what, we need to, if people want to use it for this purpose, we're actually either going to cap it and then charge a premium above and beyond a certain level.
Kevin McKinley is the managing member of McKinley Money, LLC, a registered investment advisor with offices in Eau Claire and Madison. Kevin does not intend to provide personalized investment advice through this broadcast and does not represent that the securities or services that he discusses are suitable for any investor. Investors should consult with their financial advisors prior to making any investment decision. Time now for the On Your Money email bag, and Amy writes that she and her husband own a commercial property that they are trying to sell. The tenant also just moved out, and the loan on the property has an adjustable interest rate that could rise next April. Amy wants to pull money from their IRAs to pay off the loan, but her husband doesn't. And Kevin, she wants to know who's right and yikes.
Well, Joy, we've been doing this show for several years, and I've started to identify a phenomenon that this question fits into. It's where one half of a partnership, whether it's a marriage or business partnership, family, whatever, listens to the show. The other half doesn't.
Mm-hmm.
And the one half says, you know what I'm going to do? I'll ask the question. If I get the answer to one, I'm going to broadcast it for this other half and say, see?
Yep.
And if I don't get the answer, on, he's not going to hear it, so what do I care? And I've also, by not only being a financial advisor for many years, but also doing this show, I've become really trained to recognize stressful situations, especially as they relate to money, in people. And here, I think the trigger word is, a lot of people probably didn't catch it, but the word yikes really signifies that there may be some stress or fear in her voice.
Yes. So what do you suggest that Amy and her husband do?
Well, it's understandable that they're upset, especially if they're not renting it out, they're not getting any income in, and if they're not selling it, the payments are still coming due on the loan, and they could get worse. But she should still try to rent it out for a while. One thing she could do is offer to lower the rent a little bit or shorten the lease. That might make it more attractive to not only a new renter and increase the cash flow, but also maybe a buyer who says, you know what, I want to buy this, but I want to move into it myself. And if the person already has a 3-year lease on it, it's going to be tough to get that person out of it. And finally, reducing the sales price could solve all of their problems, because if they can sell the building, they have no more payments, they get some cash out of it, they have no more need to find renters, and they may actually have a little less stress in their life, and they can say yikes about other things rather than this.
Well, if they keep the place and they can't sell it or rent it out, should they then start taking money from the IRA?
No, that should be the absolute last resort. Absolute last resort. First, go to the lender and see about a refinance, either with a fixed rate or extending out the loan for a longer period of time that allows for a smaller, more affordable payment. And if they don't like the answer, then go to another lender and see what they say. And even if the rate, let's say the rate is 6% on the loan, and next year it jumps up to 8%. I think there's a possibility of that happening, but I don't think it's likely to happen. If they have a $100,000 loan and there's a 2% jump in the interest rate, it costs them $167 more per month, about $2,000 per year. If they take that $100,000 out of their IRAs to pay off the loan and not have any more interest cost or payment, they're going to pay $30,000 to $40,000 in taxes and penalties, depending on the bracket at which the withdrawals from the IRA are taxed.
Wow. So what, though, Kevin, if they have to take money from the IRAs just to keep themselves afloat?
Well, there are a couple different ways they can do this. One is they can just draw enough out to make the payment every single month. So let's say the payment is $500. They should take $6,000 out of their IRAs in 1 year and say, good, we've got the payments covered for the time being. If they do decide to pay it off, and again, I don't recommend that they do it, they should at least split the withdrawals between calendar years or tax years. For instance, take half out in 2011 and the other half out in 2012. That might keep them from rocketing up into the top tax brackets at which the IRA withdrawals will be taxed. If they do this and they do pull the money out of the IRAs, the money that was going toward the payments should be redirected automatically into IRAs again. Because first of all, if they were making $500 loan payments, not only will the payments help replenish their accounts, but they should get a tax deduction on that money going in as well.
So it sounds like if Amy is listening right now and her husband is not, he's not going to hear your advice, is he?
I get the impression this is rarity, not to stereotype by gender, but typically there is an issue of getting rid of the payments. Women, in many instances of couples I've worked with, have had a difficult time with the monthly payment, where the guys are like, ah, it'll be fine, don't worry about it, no problem. And that goes back, I think, millions of years of genetic evolution. Not always, and this doesn't sound like the case, but I think leave the money in the IRAs, things will get better, and if you do have to make the payments, Amy, just make them very slowly out of the money. Don't take a big withdrawal out that's going to cause you $30,000 or $40,000 in taxes on a $100,000 withdrawal.
Good luck, Amy, and thank you very much for writing. If you have a question that you'd like to email, onyourmoney@wpr.org. If you have a question that you would like to pose to Kevin, 1-800-642-1234. We'll get to more of your questions in just a moment. I'm Joy Cardine with Kevin McKinley, and this is On Your Money on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Joy Cardine. Don't hem and haw, even if you're three sheets to the wind. You can learn about phrases that may be on the way out in the English language with the author of Endangered Phrases, coming up tomorrow morning between 8 and 9. Right now, this is On Your Money with certified financial planner Kevin McKinley. If you have a question for Kevin, 1-800-642-1234 or email it onyourmoney@wpr.org. And our first caller, Kevin, is Joe in Green Bay. Hi, Joe. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for taking the call. I have a question about credit cards. Over the years, I've gotten credit cards that you get a certain percentage, you're in a store, and they say, look, anything you buy today, we'll give you 10% off or 20% off if you take the credit cards. And I've built up over the years a whole bunch of credit cards, many of them I never use. And when I got the credit score from one of the credit bureaus, I see all these cards are listed on there. Now, I've heard that, you know, you shouldn't close out credit cards because it, like, lowers your credit rating if you close them all out. But if you've got all this credit online that, you know that you could be on the hook for, that works against you, too. So what's your advice? Should I close out all these accounts that I never use but are considered still open, or am I better off closing them out?
I would condemn your practice, Joe, except I remember in college in Madison opening a Marshall Fields credit card so I can enjoy a fine box of Frango mints. So that didn't even get me a discount on anything. It was a free box of mints.
You know, I think I might have got one of those, too.
I think I still have the credit card. The mints are long gone, roughly 10 seconds, I think, after I opened the credit card.
So you did not close that out, even though Marshall Fields is not here anymore.
Yeah, right. Really? What?
What? What happened there?
I still have a sweater to return. Here's what I'd say, Joe. I would definitely close those out, especially if you're not going to use it. It's not so much about hurting your credit score. And closing by credit card accounts generally will not hurt your credit score if you, first of all, ensure that on the credit report it notes that you were the person who closed the account, that it was at your trigger, not the credit card companies. And you need to check your credit data to make sure that that is shown on there, because if it looks like the credit card company closed it, that will hurt your score somewhat. Second of all, the availability of credit, it's a bit of a misnomer, because people say, well, if I have a lot of extra credit out there, then means my, and I don't use it, that means my credit score will be really, really good. Well, that part is true somewhat. There's another side of the coin, though, that says the credit card company or the credit bureau will look at that and say, hey, at any given moment, he's got $100,000 at, you know, of Kmart credit card, he can go out and charge up $100,000 on a heartbeat. We better be careful about how much money we lend to him. So having that extra availability does not necessarily always mean that it's good. The capacity is not always a benefit. And especially when it comes to store cards, everybody has done this. So I would definitely not worry about it hurting your score. It's just about the information being lost, somebody getting it. The less accounts you have, the easier it is to keep track of it. So I would definitely close out those cards unless you plan on using them. And usually store credit cards don't offer the best terms relative to, you know, more traditional MasterCard and Visa general cards.
Thanks a lot. I appreciate the information.
All right. Good luck to you, Joe. So you just call up whatever the Boston store and say, I want to close that card out, Kevin?
You actually have to send a letter in to the people who have been sending you that statement, especially if they've been, you know, have $35 a year fee or something. Write a letter saying that you want to close the account and then confirm it. And typically, if you call the place, they'll tell you the procedure as well, too, not the Boston store, but the credit card provider.
Mm-hmm. Next, we go to Diana in Janesville. Hello, Diana.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I'm a teacher. I want to retire in 2 years. I have a lot of things I have to do in order to get ready for that, but one of them is to refinance my house because I'm paying like 8-something percent now. I also want to roll into that. I have 5.5 years of service that I want to buy back. That'll go toward my retirement. And my daughter has a student loan that I stupidly co-signed on.
I don't mean to laugh. I'm sorry.
I didn't listen to you say it.
So, you know, I thought, my kid, she's always going to pay her bills. Well, anyway, she's paying them now. But I was told last year when I called around and tried to get ideas about how to refinance that, until that was paid off, nobody was going to touch me. So I have really good credit except for that. And then somebody told me maybe I could roll that into the refinance also.
I'm sorry, Diana. What type of loan is it that you co-signed for your daughter?
There were a couple. I think one is federal and one is something else. It's like 2% interest that she's paying, and it'll take her 20 years to pay it off at $100 a month. So,
Are they student loans?
Yes.
Okay. First of all, how many places did you go looking for a refinance opportunity? How many different lenders?
I just opened up the phone book and called everybody. I tried ING, which seemed to have the best deal, but it was only for 5 years. So I don't know if that's a good idea.
I would go to more local lenders, bank credit unions again today, and see what they say. Second of all, is your daughter, is she working at all?
Yes.
Okay. There is a website. Has she looked at any of those income-based repayment plans?
I think they're like they end at 16,000 or something, and she makes more than that. I mean, she's 30 years old. She's been out for a while. She didn't pay for a while, and so it kind of snowballed.
Yeah, go back to IBRinfo.org. IBRinfo.org, and we'll have a link up to that website at our website on yourmoney.com later on today. But IBRinfo.org has several different programs in place. So people who are in her situation and are struggling to make payments based on a lower income can actually lower their payments based on the income. And after regular payments over a longer period of time, whatever is left can be forgiven. Now, generally, these are just for federal loans, and there are a lot of other restrictions, obviously. But have her go back to there. Second of all, yes, I would... if the lender said, you know what, we'll give you the mortgage, but the only way we'll do it is if you have enough equity built up where you can pay off these student loans and we're doing a straight mortgage, say for 5%, say for 30 years at a fixed rate. excuse me. The issue that I have with this is I just want to make sure that she doesn't get into another situation where you're on the hook for her for lending money or for borrowing money, unless you want to be. And so you may want...
co-sign a loan for a child again.
Mm-hmm.
I've learned that lesson.
Okay, well, and you did your part. I mean, it wasn't like you said no right away. You stepped up to the plate. You did it once, and that was probably enough. So good for you. I would do any and all of those things. I would try to get her to be able to make the loan payment smaller, and if that doesn't work, then I would try to see if you can roll that back in, because, again, you're probably going to be on the hook for these regardless. Hopefully, if things get better for her, she can help you make some of the payments on the mortgage, because you had it. I would actually write up some kind of document with her, though, that said, I paid off, you know, $25,000 of your student loans for you that were in your name, and now I want you to pay me back, say, $100 a month or whatever until the payments come back, and that can help you have some paperwork in place so that you can help offset your new mortgage payment, but also keep the relationship a little bit more clean, if you will.
Mm-hmm. But I'm sorry, Diane, did you say that the lenders wouldn't give you a loan because of your co-signing of this loan for your daughter?
That's what I was told, that until that loan was paid off, they wouldn't take it, but that was a year ago. I don't know, and it wasn't everybody I went to, I guess, so...
Yeah, try again. This is a different time, for better or for worse. It may be better than it was a year ago, and keep trying. And I think you'll actually, depending on your situation, credit score, equity, this is the time to do it, though, before you actually retire, because once you retire, it's much more difficult to get the type of loan you're seeking. So good for you. But, yeah, go back to the lenders and do get that 30-year fixed-rate mortgage. Pay it off as slowly as possible, and I hope this works out for you.
All right. Thanks a lot.
Thank you, Diana, for the call, and good luck to you. Nate in Milwaukee is our next caller. Hi, Nate. You're on the air.
Hey, I just have a question about my parents. They're boomers. I'm a 20-something. They're both very, very frugal, but they have no idea about budgeting or investing. And I'm just kind of curious, what can I do to light a spark under them to get them, you know, excited about financial literacy?
Well, this is a turning, you know,
it's so typical, these boomer parents. What are you going to do, Nate? I mean, it was the Woodstock generation, and I don't think they're ever going to learn. They're, you know, they got their ARP cards now and their Dignity scooters, and I they're in the middle of the mall. I can't get to the stores. Good for you. You could make some projections for them. Go to some of the online calculators and say, you know what, I just want to make sure you're okay. And to be perfectly frank, if you're not okay, there's a concern I have that, along with the other financial goals that I have, that I might end up being responsible for your care. And I want to do that. However, I want to make sure that we've done everything we can right now to make sure that the rest of your life is as comfortable as it possibly can be. So can we just kind of put your information, or will you just put your information in and kind of project out where you're at so that you can see, at least on a numbers basis, kind of where you're at and what the next 20 or 30 years might look like for all of us. That said, I would much rather have your parents be ignorant of financial arcane data and be very disciplined, frugal people rather than the other way around. The key to financial independence has at least as much to do with being disciplined and not spending the money as it does with knowing, you know, what the PE ratio of a particular stock is and what that number may or may not mean.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Nate. Kevin, you can't get to the stores. Kevin McKinley is a certified financial planner, managing member of McKinley Money, LLC. And if you have a question for him about personal finances, we have a line now open for you at 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@WPR.org, or I should say onyourmoney@WPR.org. You know, Kevin, every other month or so, my husband, based on what's happening with the economy or the performance of the stock market, will say, I'm never going to be able to retire. And lately, he's been frightened because of this, all the talk about the, you know, the debt ceiling debate and how if the U.S. goes into default, that that's going to, you know, affect the Wall Street and all of our investments. What advice do you have for investors during this time?
Well, I would tell your husband that I rely on you, Joy, being as happy and as calm as possible to put on a good show with me.
Right.
So I tell him to back off.
There we go.
Stop causing you so much stress. Yeah, it's understandable that people would be worked up about this, and it is an issue. It's a serious issue. We have covered it from a macroeconomic basis and saying that, you know, we talked about this a few months ago, that the debt ceiling has been raised 39 times since 1980. 39 times since 1980. That's under Republican presidents, Democratic presidents. It's under Republican-controlled House and Senate, Democratic-controlled House and Senate. This is, we've been through this before. The difference is that in a very tense political time, it becomes a very tense debate. And especially when people still, you know, you can say the stock market's at 12,000, the Dow's at 12,500, and, you know, the housing market didn't completely collapse and unemployment's only at 9%. People aren't buying that this is any kind of normal recovery whatsoever. And so one more trigger of an issue, of a very hot issue, makes it difficult to concentrate on this. First of all, I don't think that the government is going to default, at least not right now. I think this is a lot of political theater. I think that they're eventually going to be coming to a resolution. And even if that were the case, if people really were worried about what's going to happen with their investments, the largest amount of money, the billions and trillions of dollars that are traded around the world, are not showing any fear over this being an issue. Now, that doesn't mean they're right. Excuse me. It just means that the people who have billions of dollars to lose in this proposition aren't worried about it. Interest rates on the 10-year Treasury have dropped from 3.5% at the beginning of the year down to 2.75%. So people are bidding the prices up of U.S. Treasuries over the last few weeks and months as this issue has come to a head.
So why would we choose debt issued by Uncle Sam?
A couple of reasons. First of all, buyers are confident that a deal will eventually get done. The bigger reason is that every other investment option out there, especially if you're talking about pieces of paper, presents other risks. You maybe reduce one risk in exposure to Uncle Sam. On the other hand, you take on a new risk whatsoever. Global bonds have just as many issues, if not more. You hear every day about problem with the governments in Europe and less so in Asia, but still. Corporate bonds, if the U.S. has some kind of default that causes rates on government debt to rise, corporate bonds will be hurt even worse. Probably the best longer-term option for people who are really worried about this are maybe certificates of deposit, because, again, it will hurt just about everything. It will be in uncharted territory. But certificates of deposit at least aren't going to have things that are, you know, it will probably have a huge demand on it. The FDIC insurance is not a direct tie to the Treasury for it. It is an implied, you know, and guaranteed support for there. But there are still all kinds of other risks inherent in this that we don't know what would happen if this were to come to fruition.
So what would you say to people with money in at-work retirement plans?
Yeah, their options are more limited because they may have, you know, 15 or 20 different fund choices, but they can't buy direct bonds. They can't buy certificates of deposit. Many people say, well, I'll put it into a money market. Well, guess where a lot of money market money is invested? The safest ones are all in United States government bonds right now. And even stable value funds. People say, well, this is an insurance company. It pays 3 or 4%. I like this. Again, they have to go put their money either directly into U.S. government bonds or into investments that probably will be hurt if U.S. government bonds fall. So the worst thing about doing this is that we'll talk about this in a few weeks, but over the last 2 or 3 months, there have been several different hiccups in the global bond market that have triggered a worry that there could be a lockup in some of these money market funds, meaning that not only that, you know, might the value drop somewhat, but also that it might be difficult to get your money out of it in the time of a crisis.
What about gold or precious metals? We get that question every once in a while.
We do get that a lot, especially, you know, when the price was at $300, nobody cared about it, but at $1,600 an ounce, all of a sudden people are very interested in it. I'd say that is an option if it helps you sleep better. However, to buy gold, especially if you buy the real metal, it's going to cost you at least 5 to 10% of the investment to get that metal in your hand. And then if you have to go to sell it, it's going to cost you another 5 to 10% of the investment, depending on how much you buy. Well, you've already guaranteed a loss of 10 to 20%, and that's assuming that the price just stays the same. Again, it's at an all-time high in a dollar basis, so you can not only incur a lot of transaction cost and friction in moving your money into gold, you can't do it in a retirement account, but then the price could drop as well. The best risk-reward out there for people who say, I do not want to own U.S. government debt, might be in stock mutual funds. I think the stock market is a very difficult place to put your money right now, but at least there's a chance that it could go up along with going down, say, 20 to 30% in a bad year. So if you are really worried about U.S. debt, you may want to say, okay, I'm going to move this money to stocks. But most people who are up in arms about the government and the deficit and the debt ceiling for sure can't move their money into the stock market.
You're listening to On Your Money on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Joy Cardine, along with Kevin McKinley, Certified Financial Planner, Managing Member of McKinley Money, LLC. We'll get to more of your questions in just a little while at 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. This is the Ideas Network. You're listening to On Your Money on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Joy Cardine, along with Certified Financial Planner Kevin McKinley. And it's time now to talk about Netflix. Netflix frustrated a lot of people, made a lot of people unhappy when it raised prices last week. And Kevin, I've heard a lot of grumbling out there, people wondering if maybe there's something else. What's going on?
Well, I would like to remind those people, and I'm barely old enough, Joy, and you are barely old enough, too, to remember buying a $699 VCR player.
That's right.
And hopefully you picked the right format, because if you got Betamax, you were out of luck for the next several years. Then renting a movie for $4 to $5 if it were available, and the most popular ones were usually gone. You got it for 2 days. If you were late, there was a $5 fee. If you didn't rewind it before you dropped it off, there was a $10 fee. And if you lost it, you had to pay for the stupid thing, so it was $70. So, yes, I understand why people are upset about this. They could use a little bit of perspective to find out how fortunate we are in this day and age to be able to get instant access to the movies. Netflix basically crushed the existing competition at the time by coming out with a plan where they offered unlimited streaming of movies for $8 per month. And then if you wanted to have one DVD at a time, it was an extra $2. For $10 a month, you got all the unlimited movies you could stream, and you could have any DVD you wanted that was available. The new plan is the streaming stays the same, still $8 per month. Now, if you want that one DVD at any given time option, it's $16 per month total. And if you want to have two DVDs at any time, it's $20 per month total.
Well, that's quite an increase in prices, isn't it?
In dollar basis, you know, it's percentage basis, it's a huge increase. It's 60% over what people were used to paying. On a dollar basis, it's still fairly low. You know, if you're talking, roughly, maybe 25 to 50 cents a day, somewhere around those range. So it's not too bad for most people, especially if they can get a couple hours out of entertainment on basically on demand. The reaction, of course, was fairly strong among users. And shockingly, you don't see this very often, but the anonymous commentators on the web were the most vitriolic and really weighed in how they were going to burn the headquarters down or whatever for the extra $8 a month or whatever. Others who took a longer look at it found out that it was still a relatively good deal, especially compared to the other offerings out there.
Yeah. So how does the new Netflix pricing plan compare to other options?
Blockbuster still does exist. It's mostly in kiosks or a mail service. There's that Red Box service that's basically a vending machine for $1.99 whenever you want. Hulu Plus, if you like streaming, is a good way to go. It's in that $8 to $12 a month range generally. Google and YouTube are still working on trying to get a suitable streaming option for all the video and the applications that they have at their disposal. You can always go to the library still and get the DVDs for free if they are available. The best deal out there, though, for people who do like streaming movies and TV shows and combining it with other services might be the Amazon Prime feature.
Why is Amazon Prime a better deal?
It's a better deal for people who do buy a lot of items that are available at Amazon and don't have a lot of time to shop around for it and want to stream movies. For $79 a year, you get the Amazon Prime membership. It allows you free two-day shipping, $3.99 one-day shipping for items that qualify. But more interestingly, they have over 5,000 movies and TV show episodes that you can download instantly for free. Now, last year at this time, they had an offer for students where the Amazon Prime membership was free. This year, they're coming out with a similar offer. It's not free anymore. It's $39. But for $39, especially if you have a kid going off to college, it allows him or her to get items delivered directly to their dorm or apartment that might be less expensive than what they would pay if they were to shop locally. And also, they get access to 5,000 TV shows and movies for free at just about any time.
That sounds pretty good. But in the scheme of things here, the Netflix price really isn't that outrageous.
Not that outrageous. And they knew exactly what they're doing. I think part of it is the postal issue of they would much prefer people to just stream movies, but they actually found that people, for $2 a month to have any DVD in your hand, they thought, well, people are taking this up much more at a much higher level than what we thought, so we're going to make it a little more cost-effective, especially since we have a lot of postage cost on top of that.
Okay, time for more calls for Kevin at 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. Oh, by the way, we have a new Money Matters website that you can check out. All of the interviews we do with Kevin and all the economic news, news reports and other information posted on Wisconsin Money Matters. And we put a link to our website. And we put a link on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page, too, if you want to check that out. Carmen in McHenry, Illinois is with us. Hello, Carmen.
Hi, thank you. My question is related to the debt ceiling also. I have some money invested at 5%, and if the account value goes up, it locks in. My amount of money stays there. I'm worried about this debt ceiling deal, and I'm thinking about changing, not companies, just different programs in their company. Did I explain that well?
Is it an annuity that you have, Carmen?
You want the name of the company? I don't think it is an annuity. They invest the money in the stock market, and it's been doing good the last month or so. I've been in it 5 or 6 weeks. But I told a financial planner that I was worried about this debt ceiling, 3 months ago when I first talked to him.
Mm-hmm.
So
I'm sorry, what's your question, Carmen?
I want to know if I should change programs in this country. In this company and get out of this, I'm worried about my account value going down.
Well, if you're worried about your account value going down, ignore the debt ceiling for a second. You shouldn't be in any type of stock market investment anyway, because I can't guarantee many things, but I can guarantee at some point the stock market will go down. And so if that's a concern of yours, you should definitely not be in there. It's not unlimited upside. That said, I think there could be a lot of volatility over the next few weeks until this gets resolved. But even after it gets resolved, there are still going to be much bigger issues ahead of the country and the world. So if you need the growth and you want the growth and you can handle the risk, you should probably stay in it regardless of the event. I have no way of knowing how this debt ceiling thing is going to be resolved, if it's going to be resolved, and even what the effect of that will be. And like I said, we're in uncharted territory here, so you definitely don't want to have all your money in it. And like we talked about before, Carmen, anything you would move it into is going to be subject to some type of other ancillary risk from a conflict over the debt ceiling be resolved.
Okay, thank you.
All right, thanks very much, Carmen. Michael in Oshkosh. Hello, Michael.
Hello. Yeah, I just did a refinancing deal on my home. I don't have that much owed, but I had about $5,000 left on a home mortgage and about $15,000 on an equity note. So I was at like 4.87 and 5%. So what I did is I got just an equity mortgage right now, and it's a biweekly payment deal. And I've got it at 299 locked in for 9 months. And after 9 months, it goes to prime or 0.25% over, which would be 399. So I'm at the mercy of whatever the interest rate goes up in 9 months. And I'm wondering if I should go back and do some type of fixed rate note on that $20,000, $22,000. I did raise it to $100,000. Accessible, not saying that I'm going to use it or not, but that's what I did. So I'm wondering what if there's something better I should do.
So you're talking in this case, Michael, about more home equity loans and home equity lines of credit, correct?
Yeah. What I did was I had a home mortgage, and I was down to about $5,000 on it. So okay. Instead of leaving that out there at 4.87, and then I had an equity note that was 0.5% under prime, but the basement was 5%, so I was at that then. So basically, my money was out there at 4.87 and at 5%. So
I think
refinance, I brought it down to 299, which would have saved me $400 this year alone on interest, but
sure.
The future is what's scaring me now.
Yep, and the future is scary. It always is and always has been and always will be. One of the problems with this is normally, as both of our regular listeners will know, I like 30-year mortgages at fixed rate, and I like them because it gives all the control and time to you that you possibly can have in terms of not only staying in your house but using the value of your equity for other more urgent purchases. But I'm guessing from your situation, if you try to get a new 30-year mortgage, they won't let you do it for a small portion of the equity in your home. You'll have to do it for a much bigger amount. If it's a smaller amount, you know, the interest rate, you're going to be paying this mortgage off anyway, right?
Yes, that's the main thing. But I guess the worry I've got is escalating interest. Now that I left myself open, I was always kind of locked in before, and now I guess I'm uncomfortable with the uncertainty of the future, I guess.
Yeah.
And
sure. Yeah, right. 9 months, he's afraid the interest rate's going to be a lot higher.
And that could definitely happen, but a lot higher, actually. You know, that's one of the things the Federal Reserve is trying to do is primed demand for borrowing up enough so that interest rates do go up. It's not working, and they're not helping, but that's something that some people would actually like. I don't think it's going to occur, and even if it does, you might want to set this up, Michael, so that the interest rate, generally in many of these cases, you can get loans like adjustable rates if you can't find a fixed rate one. I much prefer the fixed rate, obviously, so go back and try to get that. But even the adjustable ones, you can say, well, this can only go up, 2% per year to a cap of, say, 12%. So see if you can get a better term on the loan. And it's worth it for, a few $100 in fees to try to go back and refinance it so that you can eliminate the uncertainty over rising interest rates. I don't think they're going to happen. And if they do, I think you'll still be able to cover it. But setting it in place now should help you sleep better.
Good luck to you, Michael. Thank you for calling. Ryan in La Crosse is with us now. Hello, Ryan.
Hi.
Yes, go ahead, please.
My question's easy. I'm lazy and I don't want to work. I got everything paid for. I have a boat and the Keys that I want to live on. And I have $360,000. How can I make $500 a week off that, so I don't have to work. I mean, I'm sorry, but I mean, it's overrated. It's not that much fun, and it's just, I thought, you know, I'm afraid.
There are plenty of people cursing you out right now, Ryan, because they wish they could switch places with you.
Well, you don't understand what I went through for the last 10 years to do that. I mean, it was, you know, I did without, well, I guess I say I did. A lot of my friends say I didn't. But anyway, I just, that's more than what I need. But I just, there's got to be a way, and I hear all goes, oh, I'm getting 12%. So, well, where?
They're not. Well, they might be getting 12%, but they're not doing it in a risk-free investment. The safest... Actually, with all this talk of the debt ceiling, the safest place still to get a higher rate of return over the long term is to buy a 30-year United States Treasury, which pays about 4.5% right now. Now, I wouldn't recommend most people do that, and especially not with all their money, but that's a risk-free, if you will, rate of return. So other than certificates of deposit at 2 or 3%, Ryan, there's no place to get 12%. It's like the same people who go to the casino, and they always seem to win for some reason.
Well, you use it. It says I'm on a CD and 2 and 3%. I have 2 CDs, and I'm getting a buck. I'm getting 1.25% from a family banker.
Well, and you might want to keep the money local. That's probably the advantage of it. But if you go online, and we've talked about a few of these CDs in the past, you can find ones out there that are 2 and 3%, FDIC insured. You have to go out longer, but typically the penalties are not too onerous, maybe 6 months or a year's worth of interest. But that is what a risk-free rate of return provides right now. The 12% isn't out there, so you can call your friends on it if you want, but what they've got is not risk-free.
So you're telling me I'm not going to be able to do it?
Well, you can do it, but you've got to take a lot of risk on while you're trying to accomplish that.
Well, what's a lot of risk? That's what I'm concerned about, because I've got friends that, you can get a stock that'll pay you a 6% dividend.
There's a reason it pays 6%. It's because investors who pay close attention to it think that they may not be able to pay that forever, and so they're willing to lower the price down so the yield is higher. So no such thing as a free lunch. You know that, but I think your friends are giving you half as much information, and the downside of it is not being portrayed accurately.
So he can't go to Margaritaville?
He can if he wants.
Yeah,
he just has to put his money in the bank.
10 miles from my boat.
Yeah. Well, good luck, Ryan. I wish. I think we have time for one more call. Sarah in Barron County. Hello, Sarah.
Hi. I have a quick question about gold. I bought 5 Canadian Maple Leaf 1-ounce coins many years ago when gold was very, very cheap, and they've been sitting in my safety deposit box ever since. And everybody keeps saying I should sell them, and I'm not really sure if I should or even how to go about doing it.
Do you have a better need for the money, sir?
No.
Okay. Does it feel good to have them there?
I guess so. It's not something I think about every day. You know, 'cause I bought them. This was in the 80s when gold was less than $400 an ounce.
Sure.
So, and I just, my mother was an old depression person and said, you better buy that now. So I bought 5 of them, and they've been sitting there ever since. And
well, I don't know what your mother's mental health has to do. Oh, you mean like the depression era? I'm sorry.
Right.
Gotcha. Gold prices are near the high, at least in a dollar denomination. So if you wanted to sell them, you could have sold them at many worse times. But that said, if it feels good to have it, you might want to have it. How much would it bug you? Pick one of these two scenarios, Sarah, and say, well, okay, I sell it, and then it goes up to say, $2,000 an ounce, or I hang on to it and goes back down to $1,000 an ounce. Which one is going to bug you more?
I don't think either one would, because I paid so little for it.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? I guess if hanging on to it is an acceptable option, I would certainly do that. It doesn't.
Yeah, I think you were very fortunate and wise to do it when you did it. But if you don't need the money for something and you're not worried about it going back down in value, then I think it's okay to hang on them. If you do choose to sell them, I'd look locally and see who is buying gold. Usually it's better to try to sell that face-to-face rather than through the mail or online.
Thank you for calling, Sarah, and good luck. Kevin, time for the website of the week.
Well, we've talked a lot about identity theft. One of the best ways to prevent against that is to go to privacy.wi.gov and freeze your credit report. There's a template there for all 3 bureaus. It costs $10 to do it and $10 to open it up and then $10 to freeze it again at each bureau. If you want a free service, allclearid.com. Allclearid.com can do that. We'll have a link to that website up at our website, onyourmoney.com, later on today.
All right. Sounds very good. Stay cool today, Kevin, and share with us four more words before we go.
Spend less, have more.
Kevin McKinley is a certified financial planner, managing member of McKinley Money LLC with offices in Eau Claire and in Madison. Kevin will be back with us next Tuesday between 8 and 9 for another edition of On Your Money. Thanks very much to Rob Ferret and to Bill Martins for producing the show, and thank you for listening and for calling in. Hope you stay tuned. There's much more to come. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.